This is the State of Things from the studios of WCQS in downtown Asheville. I'm Frank Stacio. The head of Duke Energy North Carolina told legislators this week that moving toxic coal ash from the company's dump sites could take years and cost up to $10 billion. He says the company needs more time and flexibility to find a solution for the state's 33 coal ash ponds. Environmentalists say the problem should be addressed immediately to avoid another disaster like February's massive spill of toxic ash into the Dan River. Asheville is home to two of the state's coal ash ponds, and we'll talk about those ponds and more news with our panel of journalists. John Elliston's a reporter with the Carolina Public Press. He joins us now. Welcome back, John. Good to have you.
Thank you, Frank.
Carol Motzinger is a reporter for the Asheville Citizens Times. Welcome, Carol. Good to talk with you.
Thank you.
And with us also is Greta Johnson, who is a Morning Edition host and a reporter here at WCQS. Greta, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank. Welcome to you, too.
Thank you. Good to be here. And, John, tell us more about this now that we're here, the latest developments in the coal ash story.
Developments are moving relatively quickly in the aftermath of Dan River. Very recently, Governor McCrory advanced a plan or issued a plan whereby Asheville's coal ash ponds, as you said, there are two, would be closed relatively soon. And just last night, as it happened, State Senator Tom Apodaca, who's the GOP leader from Hendersonville, at a community meeting, he said that closing the two ponds here in South Asheville and other coal ash regulations will be probably priority number one in the upcoming short session.
Well, that's interesting to hear that new development as of last night, because there had been talk, I think Duke Energy saying they would like to cap at least one of those, and that had environmentalists concerned.
Indeed, and to hear Senator Apodaca tell it, there will be enough of a push and priority that closing those ponds will be high up on the list.
Now, talk about that now, the technology. When we say closing a pond, what do we mean? What happens to
The predominant issue is dealing with old ash. We're using some of it as infill at the Asheville Airport. There's some concerns about the liners there. There's concerns about the ponds as they are right now. Some of the groundwater around them has shown traces of thallium. And so there's not only the question of ceasing to use them, but then how and where do you relocate the ash?
And that has not been determined yet, right?
No, and it's however it goes down, it's likely to be time-consuming and costly.
All right. And the cost estimates, I guess, run from $10 billion if we close all of them and try to move them to something in the range of $2.5 billion. Is that right?
And then it becomes the question of who pays, and we know that's going to be a contentious issue.
All right. Well, we will stay tuned. We are in Asheville this week, and it is alive with technology, art, and music. Moog Fest and Electronic Music Festival has blossomed into a multi-day collaboration of artists and innovators. Carol, tell us about those who aren't familiar with Moog Fest, just what it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is a 5-day arts, technology, and innovation festival founded in honor of the late electronic music innovator Bob Moog. He moved his company to Asheville from New York in 1978, where the company Moog Music remains. And it is a combination of daytime programming and nighttime entertainment.
And the governor was supposed to be part of that and wasn't and then was. Tell us about that whole story.
When Moog Music, who are the official organizers of Moog Fest, announced the daily schedule, Governor McCrory was scheduled to kick off the event on Wednesday as part of a economic development panel with some local and regional politicians and Mike Adams, who is the Moog Music president. Last week on Friday, it was announced that he was no longer coming due to a scheduling conflict, and that came from the Moog Fest organizers, their representatives. Later, we learned that day that Governor McCrory, his camp was saying that he was actually uninvited after there was news of a protest being planned in Asheville on his arrival.
And there was, in fact, a protest.
Yes,
so
there
tell
was.
Tell us about that. Yeah,
yeah, so protest organizers, even after news broke that McCrory would no longer be part of the panel, determined that they wanted to continue with their plans, focus on the issues. And so Wednesday afternoon, there was a protest of about 75 to 100 people in the city center. And so they still came out.
They were there, and the governor still made it. He showed up at the VIP pool party, though he did. He's supposed to be part of a panel, right?
Correct.
And, and that was to talk a little bit about economic development, essentially?
Yes. So the panel, which I did attend, it went forward as planned with that topic in mind. MoogFest has really been revamped and rebranded to be an economic development tool for our region. And he was originally scheduled to be at the panel as well as the reception afterwards. So he kept one part of the original agreement.
Got there. Did you get to the party?
I got to the party after he was after he'd already left. But one of my colleagues was there and was able to speak to him. And he did talk about being a fan of symphonic rock. A fan of MoogFest in general. So
that's great. Well, he might be here for our last segment when we're going to play some of that stuff.
Exactly.
Live. We think, you know, we take it kind of personally now that the state of things is here in Asheville and we love being here. We moved the show here and we assumed that our chief groupie and biggest fan, Governor Pat McCrory, followed us.
Sure.
But now you're telling me a whole different story. We're a little crestfallen.
Yeah. And he was also originally scheduled before MoogFest to appear at a private event in a Airport Association's event on Friday at Omni Grove Park End. So he did keep that commitment as well.
We'll see. But economic development is an important part of this. Well, what does it mean for Asheville? What happens to Asheville? Let's take just this weekend, for instance.
Absolutely. Well, one thing we do know from the Convention and Visitors Bureau here in Asheville is that more than 90% of the hotel rooms that are available this weekend have been reserved. So that's pretty significant just in terms of impact on us locally. I think a lot of the economic development, we kind of have to see what happens, right? I mean, we don't have any numbers yet. But even just looking outside, you can tell that folks are here. And I think it is particularly interesting in terms of MoogFest that, you know, this the first panel they do is about economic development in Western North Carolina and North Carolina in general. It's a big priority to make technology a part of the conversation here in a really interesting way. And so it will be interesting to see how things play out for sure.
We're talking with Greta Johnson of WCQS, John Elliston of Carolina Public Press, and Carol Motzinger of the Asheville Citizen Times, and you are listening to The State of Things. We're talking about economic development, and this is a sort of a unique event. I mean, Asheville certainly is not a stranger to tourists, but this kind of event is new for Asheville or different for Asheville.
Absolutely. I talked to the brand director, Emmy Parker, of Moog Music a couple weeks ago before the festival started, and I asked her what precedent there is for a festival like this, and I think the closest thing you can sort of draw a parallel to is South by Southwest in Austin, Texas, just because it does have such a variety of programming throughout the day in addition to music at night. But even then, I mean, Austin, I don't know the population of Austin, but it's massive. You know, I mean, Asheville is fairly small. So just the infrastructure we're working with is a much different scale than something like South by Southwest.
Carol, how does an event like this come together? Talk about the mix of public and private financing that goes into it.
Yeah, absolutely. Majority of the funding is coming from Moog Music, who they have shared that they're investing $3 million in this event. They also reached out to city and county partners and have in total $90,000 from our local governments. They also have almost 30 area sponsors, too, that are providing funds and other types of resources for this event. And a lot of what actually the kickoff panel focused on is the idea that public and private resources have to be put into economic development for it to be vital and sustainable.
For an event like this, how does that work? If I have public money and you've got a private, you know, company like Moog, where do you? I mean, obviously, in-kind services. About half of the money is in terms of services, but when there's cash changing hands, where does the money go?
Well, it's actually going toward a separate organization that was created for MoogFest. So it's not like our city council wrote a check to the company. So the money is going directly to that purpose. And I know, too, a lot of the programming that Moog Music is providing to the community is free. And they're also doing a lot of partnerships with area universities, providing a lot of opportunities for students to participate for free. And
Greta, is this about, I mean, because obviously there's a great infusion of cash. When you have an event like this, people come, they spend money. That's a good thing. But what about branding? I mean, is there anything about this particular event that's a fit for Asheville? Is there anything beyond the dollars and cents?
Yes. I think that's something that Mike Adams has talked about quite a bit. He's the CEO of Moog Music. And yeah, I mean, the idea is that Asheville is a cool place to be. So then this festival is fitting for that. And it's also attracting then these other people who are these kind of creative, quirky types who find Asheville appealing on a variety of levels.
And we should mention that they've succeeded in drawing tech leaders from around the country and indeed from some parts of the world. And so there are luminaries from all sorts of firms that are here. In addition to the attendees like the rest of us, there are some heavyweight players from the tech industry that are here.
You wonder if it's all a matter of Asheville being a very cool place and a place where anybody would want to have a conference, clearly. But also North Carolina being a tech state, does that make a difference and more attractive for this kind of an event?
I think there's a lot of hope for the future, which is to say that many of the panels, including the opening one, I understand, really had an eye on more than what we're doing now, what we might be doing in the future if we were to focus resources in that direction.
And there were representatives from the Research Triangle Park and from the city of Durham on that opening panel, so it really was a statewide focus.
On the State of Things today, Carol Motzinger, a reporter for the Asheville Citizen-Times, John Elliston, a reporter for the Carolina Public Press, Greta Johnson, Morning Edition host and reporter here at WCQS. And our panel and conversation will continue on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the studios of WCQS in Asheville. I am Frank Stacio, and we're talking about news today, particularly news here in Western North Carolina with John Elliston, a reporter for the Carolina Public Press. Carol Motzinger is a reporter for the Asheville Citizen-Times, and Greta Johnson is Morning Edition host and reporter here at WCQS. So more news. The U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments this week in a case about land in Western North Carolina. It was once owned by CTS Corporation. And the question here is about whether they're still liable for the contamination and other environmental damage they've done, even though they've sold the property. That case has gone to the Supreme Court. John, tell us about the case.
This site, Frank, closed decades ago, but the toxic aftermath has been haunting residents of the area for some time. They've had tremendous problems with poison in their water and health issues and what have you. So a group of residents is trying to sue CTS, the corporation that owned the site. A state law is getting in the way. A state law waives liability for corporations after 10 years in cases like this. And the Supreme Court then will need to decide if federal law can preempt that and if this lawsuit can go forward.
And the federal laws was actually amendments, I guess, to Superfund legislation, right?
I believe so. And it's important not just for what occurs here at this site in Asheville. The ruling could affect the hundreds or thousands of claims that are arising out of the water contamination at Camp Lejeune, a very similar set of toxic chemicals is at issue and a similar set of effects.
Well, tell us about CTS. What did the company do when it owned that land? When was it here, and what kinds of toxicity are we talking about?
I believe they made electroplating parts and what have you, and by all accounts, did a very poor job of careful disposal of all the toxic soup of chemicals that they needed to use, and were dumping it somewhat randomly on the site, and it's made its way into well water and what have you. I believe the plant closed in the mid-80s, but as we said, the effects continue to linger.
And really, the contamination, it did close in the mid-80s. The contamination wasn't discovered until the 90s, and of course it'll linger. And I guess what's at stake here is that there's a kind of statute of limitations in North Carolina law that says after a certain point you're no longer liable. But what the federal law recognized is that these are long-term toxic effects that may not show up, indeed, until the 90s, even though this plant was operating well before that.
Yeah, since this toxic plume has been monitored the last 10 or 15 years, you can see how it spreads and you can see how it becomes a new problem for folks who weren't affected by it 10 years ago.
So as you said, there are a lot of other people who are watching very carefully, including the folks at Camp Lejeune and other places where the similar cases might come up, these cases of jurisdiction. So we'll talk about that and more environmental news, I guess. Following last month's landslide in Washington State, North Carolina residents are asking about their own landslide risks and what a landslide mapping project that was going on here. The funding was cut. Greta, where does it stand?
Well, it is a really interesting case. I think the landslide in Washington has definitely gotten our attention back onto this issue, as it was, obviously extremely surprising, but also just very tragic. The federal government hasn't made a national map of landslide risks since 1982, which is, you know, before, like, computer technology. And one federal agency actually calls it a cartoon map because it is just so old. So, I mean, you know, I think it's just a matter of making sure we're as informed as we possibly can be, which is obviously not the case at the moment with this map that's over 30 years old.
An over 30-year-old map, but there was a program in the state, and I think that was after Hurricane Frances, when a number of landslides occurred, and it occurred to people here. It might not be a bad idea to start finding out where we're vulnerable. So there was a project, but the legislature has taken away the funds for that. Is that right?
Yes, that is the case.
So that's gone. So what do these maps do? Because it's interesting to me that the original idea behind these maps had nothing to do with your safety in a mudslide or rainfall. It really had to do with where you were going to locate nuclear plants, to give you an idea how old they are and what the motives are. But I guess the question is, what would we do with these maps? We had a bunch of geologists active. The funding was cut. They're not working on this anymore. If we had them, what would they do, particularly if I already own the land? What would be the impact?
Well, some private firms and nonprofit organizations have stepped in to fill the gap a little bit and are continuing some of the landslide mapping. And the function it serves is really important for potential new homes, for example. You need to know your risk and what sort of engineering you might need to do to have a stable structure. It's also useful information for folks who have had a structure sitting on a potentially risky ridge for some time, and if they need to know the risk of not only what might come fall down on top of them, but we've literally seen houses during some of these rainy periods slide on down the mountain.
And is there a question also, I suppose, once you know you're in a risky place, there might be a question of whether the state has any responsibility to help out. Has that question arisen even in the debate over whether to eliminate the funding, or have you heard this at all sort of in your reporting?
Well, it becomes a big issue for emergency management. Planners, it's one more thing you have to take into account in the mountains when you have severe weather. Not only is it a matter of losing electricity or potential flooding or what have you, but if you have to worry about folks being at risk of losing their homes or being in a structure that slides away, it's one more thing to plan on.
You know, when you talk about emergency management, John, it also reminds me, going back to the coal ash story, one of the issues that's come up over the whole coal ash controversy is whether or not Duke Energy should release its plans, right? Because there are evacuation plans that we kind of feel we should all know about. What do we do in case something goes wrong? And Duke Energy says no.
Yeah, that's become and will become a greater public records issue, or rather lack of public records, because the Duke is arguing and has perhaps some justification under the law that its emergency management plans are secret, the justification being that you wouldn't want terrorists to get that information in hand in case they were to somehow try to sabotage either a power facility or one of your coal ash ponds, conceivably. Some folks don't buy that argument. Some folks think that our need to know about the risks of a potential emergency at those sites is greater than our need to not know.
Yeah, because if you don't know the evacuation plan, particularly if emergency management people don't have a chance to go over it a few times and do a couple of run-throughs, the terrorists have already done their job.
You
can't get out, right? So that's the argument, and that's going on. Now, you've also made some public records requests, as Carolina Public Press as well.
One or two, right, John?
Yeah, that's kind of our stock in trade. If you go see us at carolinapublicpress.org, and we have thousands of state government documents on a range of these topics for you to see.
Well, and one of those stories and some of those thousands of documents involve debate around an abortion clinic that was closed briefly here in Western North Carolina, ostensibly for safety reasons. But there are, you've uncovered, a number of emails that suggest there might be some political implications.
Yeah, just a quick refresher on the context. I think folks statewide will remember what a brouhaha there was last summer about new abortion legislation. And as it happens, the very week our new legislation was signed into law, an Asheville clinic was suspended briefly because of safety violations and what have you. It opened, I believe, 3 weeks later. But given the heated context of that development, we filed a records request for all of the Department of Health and Human Services records about that clinic. And they provided us some 30,000 pages of material that referenced the clinic in some fashion. And what we found were not necessarily smoking guns, but we found indications that there was a mounting pressure for that clinic to be inspected from certain legislators. And then we found a very clear and concerted, dare I say, PR campaign by DHHS to announce the suspension of the clinic in a fashion that they'd never done before or since. We don't know exactly why they decided to mount that PR offensive about closing that clinic, but you can see it was very orchestrated and very upfront. They really wanted to spread the word about this clinic's suspension for whatever reason.
Well, let's talk about this and the chronology and the legislator involved, because DHS had done routine inspections. This particular clinic was a mobile clinic, and it made it, therefore, a unique example.
This clinic, yes, was the only one in the state that had reached this ambulatory care standard that clinics across the state may or may not be required to meet soon. They're still making the new rules. We don't know if they'll go that far. So this clinic was particularly in the spotlight because it was meeting this higher standard. And so therefore, folks interested in the issue statewide have been following its fate.
So talk about what happened, because there was a request by a particular lawmaker for the safety record of this ambulatory care clinic.
And as it happens, this clinic had not been subjected to this in-depth licensure inspection for 6 years, which even the clinic owner told me personally that that's too long. They should be inspecting our facilities more often than this. And that's part of what's panning out now in the state legislature, is that the new law ostensibly provides a directive to hire more inspectors, but it hasn't really provided the funding to do so. So HHS is still waiting on additional inspectors, and we'll see if they're able to secure the funds to do so.
But what happened? Because then that initiated an inspection, which initially the clinic failed.
And we do not know to this day what initiated the inspection. We just know that it happened to be inspected during the most heated week of the entire abortion debate last summer. Coincidence? Perhaps. We just don't know.
Talk about the PR campaign in the aftermath, too, and
yeah,
some of the details.
The PR push, we learned from the records, was on behalf of senior DHHS communications officials and also the governor's top communications officials. They were working in tandem late into the evening, the night that the suspension was announced, to spread the word to statewide media outlets to the degree that they offered a five-minute early alert to my colleagues at the Citizen Times, saying, here's your scoop in 5 minutes. We're going to announce this, taking it even further where the governor's top PR folks were emailing reporters in Raleigh saying, this is a story. You need to get on this.
All right. And you're following up at the moment. So one of the questions arises, was this targeted, and was this a deliberate attempt to politicize a particular clinic at the height of this
I think it
debate?
Points up more than anything just how political the issue became last summer, to where even a years late inspection, folks would have liked to have seen it inspected earlier. Even with the best of intentions for women's health and safety, it was a political issue, pro or con.
Carol, give us a sense of the reaction to that and the fallout as this story unfolded, and kind of the public response as this story, as I say, unfolded here in Western North Carolina.
Yeah, there was a lot of interest and a lot of concern, being that it was, the only clinic available that offered a full spectrum of women's health services, and since then. There was actually a fundraiser for the clinic, if I remember correctly, over the summer. So there was a lot of community concern and interest. And actually, since then, when was this? Like, maybe a
we've just learned
month
that
ago?
Clinic
yeah.
Will close.
Yeah, it will close.
Maybe as soon as the coming month. Mm-hmm. But that Planned Parenthood has arranged to take on the patients and open a new clinic here to provide the full spectrum of services. So there'll be no break in services, even though we'll lose one clinic and gain another.
And Planned Parenthood was also planning on an expansion, already had in the works, a larger building. And so that those plans were very, far along on the road. But ultimately, the clinic will be leaving the area.
But just to be clear, Planned Parenthood, while it has been in town for quite some time, wasn't providing abortion services. So FemCare really was the only one in Western North Carolina, which is a significant issue just in terms of access, right? I mean, that's...
Charlotte would be the closest in the state that has abortion services if we were to lose them here.
And by here, we're talking about a place that's 2.5 hours from the western border of North Carolina.
That's exactly right.
So there's nothing between here and Tennessee.
Yeah, there's folks from dozens of counties around here that would receive services here.
In the same place. And when you and Planned Parenthood is here in Asheville?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Yeah, all right. We're going to talk about that. And so we should do our fun fact of the day and talk about that because – again, whenever we talk about politics and some of the mistrust in politics, the phrase we often hear is, that's a lot of bunk. And it turns out, and I'm sure the story isn't true, but Greta, it's a good one about Buncombe County and the origin.
I'm afraid
Man,
it is true.
I sure hope it's true. It is true. We've got confirmation.
All right. Oh, well, John, you know, Carolina Public Press, we know now. It's absolutely true.
I'll show you the record later.
Yeah, you've got a FOIA out
email.
On that right now.
It's actually an email that they unearthed from the archive. Bunk. This story's bunk.
Bunk, yeah. I just found that delightful. You know, I haven't made it quite a year living here yet, but that is one of my favorite fun facts about Western North Carolina. I thought that was a pretty good one. Oh, right. We haven't actually heard that. So Asheville is here in Buncombe County, and Buncombe is the origin of the term bunk. That's... And John can provide much better context for
detail.
Us.
Wow.
We had a member of Congress who, I believe during a debate over the Louisiana Purchase, wanted to filibuster. He wanted to kill some time. So he went on a rambling speech about nothing at all, put his colleagues to sleep in the House chambers. And afterwards, a reporter said, why would you prattle on like that? And he said, well, I just wanted to say my piece for the people of Buncombe. And before long, in Washington circles, nonsense political speech became known as bunk. Because of his boring speech.
That's fit.
The man from Buncombe.
How a bill becomes law and how a word enters the dictionary. You hear it all here on the State of Things. That's very good. My guest, by the way, today, John Elliston of the Carolina Public Press, Greta Johnson of WCQS, and Carol Motzinger of the Asheville Citizen Times. I really want to pluralize that, and I don't know why. I guess because you're speaking for all the citizens
exactly.
of Asheville.
We do have more than one citizen.
There you go. So it should be the Asheville Citizens Times. But in fact, it is the Asheville Citizen Times and Greta Johnson of WCQS. And you are listening to the State of Things, where we're talking about the news of North Carolina and Western Carolina in particular, since we're here at the studios of WCQS here in Asheville, ostensibly for MoogFest, but who needs an excuse to come to Asheville? So we're happy to be here. Also up in this part of the world, the Cherokee, of course, Cherokee Nation, and the casino, which is falling on hard times, I guess, slightly. Things are not doing as well at the casino as they had been.
Well, there's been a national report that overall, casino revenue is down 2%. And it comes at an interesting time because our local casino, Harrah's in Cherokee, is doing a massive expansion in Andrews. And that casino is scheduled to open in 2015. And the casino already employs over 6,000 people in Western North Carolina. And the overall economic impact of the Cherokee branch already in existence is worth about $380 million, according to a 2011 survey. So it's a huge, huge employer and you know revenue generator in our area.
Do you know how the wealth is distributed? What other benefits does the nation receive from the casino apart from employment?
I'm not sure of exactly the reservations benefits. I can tell you that the casino accounts for 8% of all the wages in a 2-county area outside of the reservation, and that it does account for also 5% of jobs in that area as well.
Yeah, I think it has a huge impact on employment, but my understanding also is that profits are able to go into infrastructure there, like building new schools and those sorts of things, which are incredibly crucial in that region of the United States.
And certified members of the tribe receive an annual allotment, a portion of proceeds. I think we were guessing earlier that it's somewhere around $9,000 now. Mm-hmm. So that certainly has an impact as well.
Well, what about this new development and investment? Has that been controversial? It might be a tough time, or are folks pretty optimistic that it's going to pay off?
We did a report in February and spoke to a lot of Andrews residents and business owners. They're positive. based mostly off of those numbers that I just told you about economic impact. And what's important to note is it's going to be a $110 million investment in that Andrews area. And that's the biggest change to the economy since 1940. And the last time – and that change in 1940 was the building of the Hiawassee Dam by the federal government. So it's big, big money. And there's a lot of excitement and some trepidation, but I think mostly – excitement of that attention being put to a very rural area of our state.
Yeah, I'm going to be the skeptic of this story and say that really the possibility of a slowdown in revenue still is implying pretty drastic growth in general, especially compared to no casino at all.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Mm-hmm. What a pleasure to finally meet you face-to-face and be able to talk to you about all these important issues. Greta Johnson's the Morning Edition host and reporter here at WCQS. Carol Motzinger, a reporter for the Asheville Citizen Times. Thank you, Carol. And John Elliston, a reporter of the Carolina Public Press. You can find links to all of these great organizations at our website, stateofthings.org, and I encourage you to do so. A lot of great reporting from all of these outlets. So please do. And thank all of you for being on the program. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us on the State of Things. Moog Fest music with techno musician Erica just ahead.